Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
And they knew that I had been making a lot of new wines for Gallo. And so they quickly, the chairman of the board came out to talk with me, and I met him at the Oakland airport, and very impressed that this guy would take the trouble to talk to just a flunky, just a winemaker at the winery, and he was very glowing. He wanted to give me a big job. It was going to be a great job. He wanted to offer me vice presidency of Italian Swiss Colony and put me in charge of all the wine. They were making wine and they had Lancers in Portugal, and they wanted to expand that. They wanted me to make a white wine from Lancers, and of course I did that for them, but not as vice president of Italian Swiss. I simply turned him down, and I later learned that's something you don't do to a chairman of the board of a company that's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. You just don't say no to a corporation like that. But I didn't think I had any choice. I didn't see how I could tell him, yes, I can make all these things from Thompson Seedless, when I knew it couldn't be done. So so I turned him down on that job, but they did not fire me. They kept me on, and they started sending me to Portugal, and I did go there, and I made White Lancers, and it was very successful. Lancers had been only rosé prior to that, and a pretty big seller. But within, I think it was 2 years, the White Lancers passed up the rosé. It was a very successful wine. And the reason is I had really good grapes to work with. They had good grapes in Portugal, and as they do all over Europe, or as they did then and still do. So that was very successful, and all along I stayed at BV through six vintages, 5.5 years, but six vintages, 1968 through 73. And those were some of the best wines that I could have hoped to get lucky and make. 68, even today, is probably considered what in the history of the company is probably the best year that BV ever had. The best vintage wines, and 1970 was almost as good, and I of course made both of those wines. The 68, Andrei Chelyshev, the man that I replaced, is just a fabulous, probably the greatest winemaker that I could ever meet, and was lucky enough to work with him. He was there the whole year of 68. I was appointed winemaker, but Andrei was fully involved in that, because he was teaching me the whole year how to make wine properly, how to really do it right. The other guy that I learned wine from, I learned at Gallo, and it was Andrei's son, Dmitri Chelyshev, was just a superb winemaker. I wasn't at Gallo more than 2 or 3 days before I realized that he really knows. The other winemakers don't know. And Dmitri, of course, had been taught by his father, Andrei, and that was why he was so good. He didn't want to stay at Gallo. Things didn't work fast enough for him, and so he moved away. But after teaching me how to make new products and so on, and then I took over that after just a couple of years, Dmitri moved down to Mexico, Bodegas de Santo Tomas, and he started making wine down there and cleaning the place up. He had told me, and Andrei had told me, that when Andrei first came to this country in 1938, Beaulieu, because nobody, Americans can't pronounce Beaulieu the way it's supposed to be pronounced, and they'd call it Beaulieu and Beaulieu, and they had all kinds of names. And so Beaulieu got the idea, well, we'll call ourselves BV, Beaulieu Vineyard. And BV, it got to be known as BV. Well, when Andrei first came to BV in 1938 to start really winemaking at BV, he found just a mess. Everything was spoiled, it was bacterial, Volatile acidity, which is volatile acidity, is a chemist's way of saying vinegar, and that's what it was. Alcohol gets oxidized by bacteria into vinegar, and it's called volatile acidity because it's an acid and it's volatile. And everybody knows you can smell vinegar a mile away. So Andre's first couple of years he spent in cleaning up BV. Well, when Dimitri left Gallo in about 1960, possibly 61, to go down to Bodegas de Santo Tomas in Ensenada, Mexico, I got a phone call within a week or so, and he said, "Dick, would you send me a case, a whole case of Gallo Paisano wine?" Gallo Paisano was a wine made 100% from Zinfandel. It was a very, very nice red wine, and sold like hotcakes. It was a very good, clean wine. And I said, "Sure, I'll send them to you as samples. I'll send you a case of it. It'll be called samples, and so we'll pay the freight and everything just to get down there to help you." But I said, "Tell me why do you want it?" He said, "You will not understand this." He said, "When I came in here, this place was so filthy. Everything had VA. Everything was vinegar. There was no wine that wasn't vinegar." And he said, "I've been trying to..." Dimitri was born in Paris when his father was studying in Paris, so his first language was French. The first 6 or 7 years, that's all he spoke. He never took a Spanish lesson. He just went down there knowing English and some French. The French that he, well, I guess you probably wouldn't forget it if you learned it right from the time you were born. So he went and very quickly picked up Spanish. But in his broken Spanish, the first time he was down there, he said, "I am unable to explain to them what to expect if we clean the place up." He says, "I'm trying to clean up the winery here. I want to get rid of the volatile. And they don't have anything that isn't volatile, so I can't show them. I want these samples to show them what it'll taste like if we get it cleaned up." So I laughed, and that's what he did. He really cleaned up Bodegas de Santo Tomas, and today it's one of the top wineries in Mexico, all due to Dimitri Jeloshev. So he followed what his father had done in 1938 when George Delatour, the founder of BV, tried to find, when he decided he wanted to get into, prohibition had been repealed 4 or 5 years earlier. So now he had this winery. He was making, he was the chemical engineer, and he was making cream of tartar, which is a byproduct of wine. It crystallizes out inside wine tanks, and you have to scrape it off the inside of wine tanks and barrels and re-precipitate, or you know, re-clean it up, and then you can be sold as cream of tartar, which is what it is. When George tried to find a winemaker who knew how to make wine in America, there weren't any. And there weren't any because America had just finished Prohibition and nobody studied wine and nobody knew how to do it. And so he had to go to France to find somebody who knew enough about wine to start his company. He did that in 1937. Andre came to this country in 1938 and underwent his program of cleaning up the company, cleaning up all the tanks and burning a lot of the barrels and so on. So that by 1940, 39 and 40, Andre was making very, very good wine. He had more than just French Colombard and Chenin Blanc, which is what we had at Gallo. He had Chardonnay. There were a few wineries then that had it. Louis Martini did, Charles Krug did, Behringer did, but they ruined it. They had such bad spoilage in their winery they couldn't succeed. They ended up selling their company because Behringer was a laughing stock of Napa Valley back in those days. Today it's not at all. Today it's one of the top quality wineries in Napa Valley. Due to Myron Nightingale, when he came in and just cleaned up Behringer by burning up everything and starting with new wood, new tanks, new grapes, and a rigid law that he put down. Everything's going to be clean, it's going to be sanitary, it's going to be perfect, and I'm going to taste everything that goes out of here. And he did that and cleaned it up. So that's kind of the history of Napa Valley. There were a few wineries that were making pretty good wines, Martini, Krug, and BV, pretty much. That was it. And there were a few others, five or six others, that that were making so-so wine. They were using Colombard and Chenin Blanc, all right, but they weren't using Chardonnay, which, and Cabernet and Pinot Noir and so on. So that's what the book explains. It goes into the history of the wine business, both in the coastal California, like Napa and Sonoma, and Monterey, and the Central Valley, the main volume areas of the wine business. Up and down the Central Valley is where these wines were made, and that book, I think, gives a real clear picture of just how that happens. And that's why the book is so successful. People like it. They like reading it. The only one I have to credit for that is my wife, Sandy, who is an avid reader. And she was a first grade teacher, so she knows how to teach, and she's an avid reader. We didn't know it at the time, but it made her an excellent book editor. And so when I think that I've been talking here for a long time, and the listener is going to recognize right away that I tend to scramble in all directions. And I wrote that same way. And so I wrote this book in all directions. And then I got smart and had her start nitpicking what I wrote. So maybe I'd write 4 or 5 days. I'm sorry, write 4 or 5 pages in a single day, and then I'd give it to her, and she dutifully took it over and read it carefully and took her pencil and started marking things up, and then when I'd see it, either late that night or the next morning, there'd be just marks all kinds on all over the place. Move this paragraph to page 16 because that's what you're talking about there, and here it's out of place. Move this, eliminate this paragraph altogether, and then over here, eliminate this whole page altogether. And it does something to your marriage the first time you have to throw away a whole page that you spent an hour on, or 2 hours on. And but then I would go ahead, and we have a very solid marriage, and so it succeeded. What I did is I'd go ahead and type what she had asked me to do. I did exactly as she said, and then I wouldn't read it. I'd wait till the next morning and then read it the next morning. And son of a gun, it was so much better than how I had written it that we got by a rough spot there. And from then on, I just took exactly what she said and I did it. If she said, no, put this... get rid of this subject. You don't want to put it in here at all. Do that. Expand that one some more. And over here, you need to, you've changed subjects, but you haven't led into it. So give me a paragraph that leads into this. And so that's how I wrote it. And that's why, as far as I know, nobody has criticized this book. I've never gotten anything but 5 stars in it. And really, I credit Sandy's ability as a book editor. If she had wanted to make money in her life instead of being a first grade teacher, she should have been a book editor because she's really good at it.
Wow. First of all, as a writer, I can validate it fully. A lot of writers that people credit, and rightly so, with talents, honestly, they're only as good as the editorial support. So I'm not surprised to hear you recount the actual practical application, meaning that you're an extraordinary storyteller, and I've been hanging on to every word, as I'm sure people that are listening. But writing is a whole other animal, mm-hmm. and it's different than verbal presentation, and it's really important that everything is succinct and cohesive and, yes. you know, reads well. In this book, I devoured it, literally. I could not put it down. I stayed up, I think, when I first got it from you, till like 4 a.m, I just couldn't put it down.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That's very complimentary.
It's an amazing read, and as you pointed out, it's truly an American history as well. I mean, it's called The Winemaker, and yes. that's a proper title, but it also is a historical piece.
Yes, really it's important. History. It's history. The Do you have the sheet that is inside that?
I do.
The editor, this book won a main award, a Gourmand Award, and the guy who, he said, I've read The Winemaker several times. It should be required reading for all winemakers, all who want to invest in wine, and all wine writers. Some authors are known for one masterpiece, as he equally proud of his wines and his book. This is one of my, here he says, this is one of my five favorite wine books. I have over 1,400 in my library in California. That's Edward Cointreau, the Cointreau Spirits family in France, spirits and wine, and they have his daughter is making wine down in Santa Barbara right now. And but to say that all these people, anybody interested in wine, a winemaker, they ought to read this book. That's why it's successful, I think, and it's on my website as well. My website is richardgpeterson.com. There's no dot after the G. It's just Richard G. Peterson, all run together, .com, so they can buy it at Amazon or there. But the reason I think it's successful and why it gets such rave reviews and why it doesn't get any bad reviews is really goes back to Sandy's ability as an editor. I really think she just cleaned it up beautifully.
Clearly. No, that's really impressive. This book covers so much. It covers a history that I think should be taught in every school. If I could propagate it, if I could clone you, I would place you everywhere.
That reminds me, I've done a lot of writing, but it's all technical writing. I've written I'd write a chapter for a quality control chapter for a wine book that somebody has done, a professor has done, and he asked me to write that. So I did that, and I've done a lot of writing, but I didn't have to stick to the point particularly. I was free to flow, but in a book like this, you need to stick to the point. And so that was new for me to learn, and I'm really glad to hear you say it. It reminded me when you said that, it reminded me of a book, one of the English classes that I took as a freshman at Iowa State was a study of the book, and it was Autobiography of Lincoln Steffens. Lincoln Steffens was a writer Theodore Roosevelt was president, would have been around 1908, 1909, 1907, 8, 9, 10, something like that. And Lincoln Steffens wrote an autobiography, and that was our textbook. I'd loved it if this book would become a textbook to learn, to teach people about, not the first part maybe, when I was a childhood, you wouldn't have to put that in there, but at Gallo, what kind of research did we do at Gallo? Well, the book has got that, and it explains in detail. The oak chips, when we were trying to, Gallo didn't want to go to the trouble, the expense of putting in so many barrels, because barrels are very difficult to handle. You had to handle them all by hand, and there's no way to handle barrels mechanically then. And they wanted to avoid that. Well, you can buy oak chips from barrel companies. National Distillers makes barrels in Memphis, Tennessee. There's a plant there. I went there to see how they did it. And they chip up oak. They're building barrels. They're building barrels for the liquor people. And all the stuff left over, the chips and sawdust, they just sweep up off the floor. And using air, they would blow it into like a reverse vacuum cleaner. They'd suck it up off the floor and then blow it out the other end of the vacuum cleaner into a rail car and just pack a rail car full of oak chips. You can get 29 tons in a rail car. I happen to know that from doing this. And so we started buying oak chips. The problem is every batch of wine we put in oak chips was different. And we couldn't figure it out. We didn't buy our chips from National Distillers yet. We started buying them from various people around who were selling oak chips. And we'd get a good batch of oak chips from a guy, and then the next time they'd be terrible. Go to a different person. Well, he never did have good chips, so we didn't stay with him. Go to a third guy. He'd have good chips sometimes and bad chips. And we couldn't figure it out. We just could not put our finger on what it was. And we tried all kinds of experimentation in the lab, you know. Do you treat oak chips? Do you toast them a little bit first? Do you treat them with acid? Do you treat them with base, caustic? What do you do? We could partially degrade oak chips, and you get a lot of vanilla out of it. Oak chips turn out to be the fiber in oak is lignin. Well, lignin turns out to be a polymer of vanilla, believe it or not. And as a chemist, that was very surprising to me, but it's true. It's very easy to break down lignin, and what you get is a whole lot of vanilla, and it's beautiful. The smell of vanilla is really good. And oak chips, when you toast them a little bit, you get a little bit of this vanilla because it breaks down the lignin, and you get vanillin compounds. But we still couldn't get good, no matter what we did and tried, we could not figure out why we had good oak chips sometimes. Well, Julio, a guy named Bob Bouthillette, one of the people who hired me at Gallo, he was in charge of the research department when he hired me, and he didn't stay very long at Gallo. He was only there about a year and a half. But when he did this, he met a guy. He started searching around for oak chips, and he found a guy in Oakland, California, and he was producing oak chips, and over again, his were better than anybody else's, and we didn't know why. And this guy was a real BSer, and he as Bouthillette was, and they talked to each other, and it was, boy, one guy'd tell one big story, tall tale to the other one, and the other double it, you know, and tell it right back, tall stories. And so we couldn't ever believe whatever Bob told us that this guy said he was doing. We didn't believe it. We didn't know, we couldn't tell what he was doing. And he was charging like $300 a ton for oak chips, and they were the very best. They were far better than anybody else's. But $300 a ton for yellow, that's a very expensive thing. And Julio wanted to beat that. So I got the idea. Okay, I'm a chemical engineer. I can recognize equipment. I'll just don't shave for a couple of days. And those days it took me probably 3 or 4 days to have a beard show at all, because my beard was light anyway and kind of reddish blonde, and so I'd go long enough, and then I came in wearing old clothes, and Gallo arranged to have me go along as a worker, just wearing work clothes. I was just some kid, you know. I was 28 years old, but I could. I got asked for ID sometimes. I looked young, and when I wore old clothes and so on, just came as a worker, nobody thought anything of it. Well, I went along with the truck to go and pick up the oak chips. They were in bags. And the owner, the guy who had been BSing with Bouthillette to trying to sell us chips, and was selling us chips at $300 a ton, so he came out and he looked over the truck and looked at me and looked at the guy, and I just looked down, and the driver and his helper were here, and so he said, well, that stack over there is yours, you load those up. So we did. We went over and we started loading 50-pound sacks of oak chips onto this flatbed truck. After a while, I looked around. I couldn't see anything, couldn't even get into the building. And after a while, I asked the guy, he's standing there watching us. And I said, do you have a restroom? Oh, yeah, he says, go through the door there and go in to the right and all that. And there's a Coke machine there, too, if you want. So I went in the restroom, and I didn't have to go to the restroom, really, but I went in there and looked, and my eyes open. I couldn't find any hog. A hog is a chipper, you know, to chip wood with. And and this guy had told Boutalette that he had to set his hog exactly right, precision setting, and that's how he got the chips that made such good wine extract. And but there was no hog there. All I saw is a rail car there, and I went over because the owner of the place, a guy named Tony Baird, did not follow me in there, or he maybe followed me in there, but then he went back out to watch the guy, the driver. Anyway, I had an instant there that was free, and I ran over to the rail car, and it had a National Distillers bill of lading on it, and I saw it was just full of oak chips. And what they were doing is they were vacuuming out, unloading the car with a vacuum cleaner, probably 6, 7, and 8 inches in diameter, sucking out these chips and running through a hose. And it went into what called a cone separator. And a cone, I recognized what it was. It spins around, and the dust stays in the middle, and the dust goes to the outside. And the chaff and all that, the chips fall down the middle, and they were separating the dust from the chips, and then they were bagging them up, and they bagged the dust with one bagger and sewed the top, and then they bagged up the chips from the other. They had two workers in there, guys working there, bagging up dust and chips, and. I said, "How come you're separating these?" Well, he said, "The butcher shops don't want chips. They're in the way. They want dust. They have dust on the floor. I don't know what we do with the chips," he said. And what I knew is he was sending them to us because they were chips. And there was no other equipment in that facility. Just the cyclone separator. The sewing machine and the funnel that where he separated the, and so I mulled that over as I went back out, and I made a couple trips back and forth to get Cokes and so on, and Tony Baird's watching the whole time, and so we finally loaded up and we left, drove back to Gallo in Modesto, and all the way along I started wondering, could it be that the dust, you know, you make paper out of dust, oak dust, and we had some of the bad lots of oak chips. They gave the wine that, well, you took oak chips and then you ran wine over them and let it sit for a while, and then you take the chips out, and then you tasted the wine, and that was called an oak chip concentrate, and we'd put a small amount of that in whatever wine we were bottling, and that's how we got the oak flavor in the wine. Well, when we did that, sometimes we got a very papery off flavor. And I started wondering, my gosh, I wonder, could it be that the dust is what gives us the chips, the papery flavor? Because dust is very easy to dissolve. I mean, wood is not soluble, but any treatment you give it is going to break off little molecular size pieces that could taste like paper. And that's how paper is made, of course, from chips like that. By the time I got back to Gallo, I went in and I told the people what I saw. I said that there's no hog there. They're not making any chips. They're getting them from National Distillers. And in Memphis, Tennessee, I got the address. I memorized it. And well, let's try it right away. So we looked, and our chips were clean. There was no dust on them. They're just chips from Tony Baird. That's why they were good. And we got some of the others. They had dust in there. So we separated out in a little screen in the lab, and we soaked some wine overnight on the dust and soaked some on the chips. The chips came out real nice wood flavor. The dust was papery. My gosh, we had the answer. And I call that oak chip espionage, I think, in the book. But that's the kind of research we did at Gallo. We were focused on, by gosh, producing the best wine we could. We wanted to beat Italian Swiss for a while, and then we wanted to beat anybody else. And most of all, we wanted to have the best oak flavor out of chips, and it turned out to be that. And so that we did by espionage. So we tried anything we had to try to win, and that's how we did it.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.